Imagine driving home from work tonight, and when you're a few miles away, your oven turns on to 450. It already knows that you're making a pizza because you forwarded the recipe you were reading online to your kitchen appliances. And good thing you did, because your fridge tweeted that it's low on mozzarella. And the wine rack chimed in too and said you'd better pick up something unless you want your Pinot Grigio. When you get home, the lights switch on to guide you to the kitchen, and your favorite Italian crooner comes on the stereo. All this may someday be possible with the Internet of Things. It's a time when light bulbs and toasters and cars and sprinklers and smoke alarms, refrigerators, whatever, they're all these appliances, they're all hooked up and talking to one another over the Internet. But will they be able to talk to one another in a common language? Will it just be a bunch of electronic gadgets that can't communicate because your KitchenAid doesn't speak Sub-Zero? And what if you want to listen to Metallica while you make pizza, not Sinatra? Can we train smart systems to understand the whims of their unpredictable human owners? That's what we're going to be talking about with my guests. Let me introduce them. Neil Gershenfeld is co-author of the article As Objects Go Online. It's out now in Foreign Affairs. He's also director of MIT Center for Bits and Atoms in Cambridge. He joins us from WGBH today. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Gershenfeld.
Hi, Ira. Happy to join you.
Thank you. Scott Jensen is an interactive designer who works in product strategy at Google in California. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Jensen.
Hello.
Let me ask you both, did I describe pretty well, Neil, what an average day might look like? Give us what we might see going on.
Well, I think what's most interesting about Internet of Things isn't what you described, where it's obvious. Mm-hmm. The really exciting things are when it's not obvious. People have been making smart homes for years that just haven't been that exciting. Where it really gets exciting is numbers like in the U.S., 3/4 of electricity is used by buildings, but 1/3 is wasted for very stupid reasons. By putting light bulbs and doorknobs and thermostats online, you can recover this huge number of about 1/3 of the energy wasted, which dwarfs any other kind of energy resource we have available. Mm-hmm. Or billions of dollars are wasted from healthcare compliance, people who can't manage medication.
Right.
So some of the most profound implications are the most invisible ones, like those.
Okay, we're going to come back and talk more with Neil and Scott. Our number is 844-724-8255, talking about the Internet of Things, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry and go to our website at sciencefriday.com and join the discussion over there. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the Internet of Things with my guest Neil Gershenfeld, co-author of the article As Objects Go Online and now out in Foreign Affairs. Scott Jensen, interaction designer who works in product strategy at Google in California. Our number is 844-724-8255. Now, Scott, you're very much involved in Google with how people use things, right? The user experience.
That's correct.
And what is the optimal user experience then for the Internet of Things?
That's what we're trying to all discover. Right now, people get so excited about this fully automatic system that you talked about, where you just drive home and everything happens automatically. And that's most likely going to be a bit naive, because sometimes humans want to do crazy, silly things. So I think we're going to find this kind of interesting mix between automatic things and then things that I then intend to show to the system, and I give it simple commands that then maybe unlocks a lot more extra automatic things.
Because if you try to think of it in, you know, at the end game, it has to sort of read our minds. If we, you know, doesn't the Internet of Things will have to know what we're kind of thinking as humans? We're not, you know, mechanical. They have to try to guess what's on our mind.
Well, precisely. And that's the whole reason why I write about this, because right now the approach people are taking is to make it fully automatic and try to read your mind. And humans just tend to be a little bit more squirrely than that, and we aren't that predictable. So I think what we'll have is simple automatic things like dimming the lights and saving energy that doesn't hurt anything. But then you might just say, play Sinatra.
Yeah.
Or play Metallica, yeah. And then it'll do the right thing for you.
Mm-hmm. Neil, when I wake up, for example, you said there were things that we were thinking the simplistic ideas for the Internet of Things, but they're much more useful and important things going on.
Yeah, so picking up, what makes this possible is it's possible to make a web server for about $1 with a few thousand bytes, with a few thousand transistors in a fraction of a millimeter, so it can go into anything, light bulbs, doorknobs, all the things around you. And many little things network has really big implications. So again, buildings waste about a third of three quarters of our electricity. And one reason is inefficiency. Things like lights don't know there's natural light. But a bigger one is deficiency. It turns out they're basket cases. The buildings we've looked at are full of like pumps going in the wrong directions or air conditioning when it's colder outside. And you're familiar with these, but you don't have a way to solve them because the building is controlled centrally. And that's very similar to what communication was like before the internet, where you couldn't change a telephone, you had to change the central office switch. So by bringing lights and thermostats onto the internet directly, it means you can build applications at the edges of the internet rather than being limited by what the building is connected to.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that one of the things that concerns you from your piece in Foreign Affairs is that you're worried that none of these appliances are ever going to be able to talk to each other. It's like the old battle between your VCR can't play Betamax, or your Macs can't open Windows files back in the day. We need to have something that's common, right, for them, so that your fridge can talk to your toaster or whatever.
Right. We're currently living through, I guess you could call it, a technical version of Churchill's maxim of doing every alternative option until you get around to doing the right thing. Technically, the internet was something of a battle between it and the bitnet. The bitnet was centrally controlled. You had a terminal and you did what the mainframe did. In the internet, the state was at the edges of the network. So you could invent what you did by changing what you connected to the internet. Mm-hmm. That sounds obvious, but it was a battle at the time. In the Internet of Things today, that battle has come back. Many of the things you hear called Internet of Things aren't. They're, in fact, exactly the bitnet of things. And what it means is the devices we're talking about, the sensors, actuators, the things around you, aren't connected directly to the internet. They're connected to a technical analog of the old phone office switch that decides what they can do. So the way to get to the Internet of Things is to really learn from the history of the internet, which is the devices around us themselves have to be part of the internet, not dumb devices connected to a remote controller.
Scott, do you agree?
I absolutely do agree. And I think that since there's been so much activity with things like the Apple iTunes, businesses tend to get really excited by this idea of creating this lock-in and mentality of pulling their users into a little wall. And so a lot of companies are trying to duplicate that right now, and it just isn't really effective.
So we should have open source then, is what you're saying, Neil. Everything should be open source and out to the internet, and people can fix and suggest better ideas how to make them better.
Yeah, open source and open standards. The standards have to be open. To give you an example of this difference, it's really profound between who controls your devices. I was visiting a tech company that didn't really understand this history. So they were going to make a controller in your house that would run everything in your house. And they had a user interface, which was a little physical robot. And they were showing it to me. And the robot tripped and started pounding the floor while saying, "I'm in control of your house." And the engineers didn't really see the irony in this sort of mutant robot pounding the floor saying, "I'm in control." And that's really the difference in the futures we're talking about. We went through this before. Phones or terminals were limited by what the people in charge centrally could do. The strength of the internet came from being a distributed solution. And so we know how to solve these problems. We need to work through this script of central versus distributed solutions. You need to be very leery when you hear the phrase Internet of Things. Ask who controls the information in the devices. Are they directly part of the internet? And you'll see many of the things called it, in fact, aren't.
Yeah, and Scott, you had another post called Stormy Sky of Cranky Clouds about the fact that there is no one cloud. Every company has its own cloud storing data. How is that useful to me, the end user?
Well, you just have to go back to, say, the Quantified Self conference in San Francisco last year, where there was a mini riot that occurred when everybody that had their own individual device, and a lot of people will have two or three of them, all go up to their own cloud. And that data can't go together. And that's where the really power comes together. If I have five heart rate monitors, it'd be nice if I could have all of that data go in one place. And I could then do analysis and see where I'm doing over the day. And right now, that is completely impossible. And consumers are just not having it.
But they're going to be thinking about their security a little bit. I can keep at least my stuff to in my cloud that I don't want everybody else to see if it gets in a central cloud.
But that's actually, I think, the story that the manufacturers are trying to tell, where security is a solved problem. You can have an open system, open communication, and an open cloud, and still have all your data be secure.
Do you agree with this philosophy, Neil?
Yeah, well, I'd go even further. Historically, security failures come from three things that these central systems are getting wrong. One is where you centralize rather than distribute. One is when you try to be secure by being obscure, by hiding the model for the security. And ultimately, when it's people are the vulnerability. We know how to make secure systems. You need to liberate the devices so that you can implement that.
Can you give me a scenario of a day, what you think it would feel like in the optimal case? You know, I'm thinking about, let's say I wake up, I'm waking up in the morning, and my clock radio, which is part of this system, knows that I'm waking up and says, "Good morning, Ira. Would you like a cup of coffee?" And I say, "You know, I'm not feeling so good." And maybe the clock radio knows, "You know, I monitored your blood pressure today. It's a little high. Maybe you ought to call the doctor, and that's why you're not feeling good." Is that the kind of thing that might happen?
No, really the most exciting implications, I think, are going to be invisible. And they relate to privacy. Privacy isn't an absolute good. By you controlling your devices, your data is valuable. You can price it. So if you're a senior and you've fallen, privacy isn't good. You want to get help.
Right.
For healthcare, you could maintain secrecy in your devices, but if your doctor and your healthcare provider know about your medical habits and practices, if you share the data for them, they can give you better care and better price on insurance. So a lot of these really interesting applications that have to do with a quality of life, energy, things like that, don't have to do with you talking to Hal. They have to do with the devices quietly working in the background.
I like the way you brought Hal into this. That was.
Could I add to that a little bit?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I think that people often forget that there's this 10-year delta between Netscape and Gmail. Sometimes it takes a while for a kind of a technology to kind of evolve. And there's this relationship between consumers and the technology, and they kind of just get better over time. And so right now we're all excited about things turning on and off automatically. And that clearly is fun for now. But my guess is, much like Neil says, is that we're going to be at really much more subtle, interesting things. We'll create lighting systems in the house that would be impossible to build today with individual switches. So we're going to kind of grow into this and have it be doing nuanced, subtle things that we're going to value a lot. But it'll take time for us to grow into it.
Yeah, if I could give you an example to illustrate that. I made interactive furniture at the Museum of Modern Art a number of years ago, and they didn't want computers in the galleries to get in the way of the art. So we filled the furniture with internet nodes and made it interactive. And it was a little awkward because people at the opening were more interested in the furniture. But one of the museum benefactors came over, and she was beaming because you could use the table to navigate through information. And she was pounding the table saying, "This is great. I love this because I hate computers. And there's no computers here." The table she was pounding had about 20 internet addresses and a few hundred processors.
Hope she didn't break any of them.
Yeah, but that's exactly the point. At that point, it's just a nice piece of furniture.
Yeah, because everything will be a smart something, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. The opposite will seem odd.
Yeah. And you know, we talk about the next great smart thing are going to be your cars. You know, cars are... I was reading the other day about chip makers making your cars able to talk to each other now. And that sounds like a very smart thing because that may keep them from, you know, from getting in touch and hitting each other if they each know where they are.
Yeah, cars are a good example of the strength and weakness. Your car today has about 20 or 30 processors in it. They're already doing a lot of what we're describing. But cars are one of 20 different domains that felt like they had to reinvent the internet. So cars, building consumer electronics, they're all making their own version of a redo of the internet. And they're making all the mistakes the internet did.
Such as?
To stay with your example of cars, to do car-to-car communication, you need to route.
Yeah.
Then you need to build in the security models and the naming models and all these things we've learned to do in the internet. And so this battle of what you can think of as the internet versus the bitnet of things is not repeated reinvention of the history of the internet, but the recognition is for a dollar you can implement the internet, and it's learned how to solve all of these problems. So what really makes sense is not one internet connection for the whole car, but actually bringing IP into the lowest levels of the car.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Brighton, Michigan. Alexander, welcome to Science Friday.
Well, you've already addressed some of my question. I just wanted to talk about how in the era of increasingly pervasive digital attacks, that all your, you know, personal health data, and if it's going to be controlled from your phone, like you were talking about with the recipe, they could backdoor into your other important information if you have your entire life linked up to one network. And that just seems like there's something missing, that there's some sort of extra security layer that doesn't seem to be present. Maybe I don't understand it. But.
Yeah, that's good. Scott?
Sure.
Well, there's clearly a more exposed attack vector if you have all of your information into one spot. But again, we are solving this problem. We've got secure ways of transmitting data and locking it down. And as Neil says actually in his paper, that 9 times out of 10, the ways in which we lose this data is through human means, which is that someone like walks into your house and goes through your trash. So the odds of this being as bad as people claim it is going to get significantly better and not bad as people think it is. Mm.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Neil Gershenfeld and Scott Jensen. So we're in what you might call a shakeout period, or are we still not even in a shakeout? We're still in the very early development stage.
I would claim that we're kind of in the vocabulary period. It's just understanding what the stuff can do. So, for example, I don't like the word smart as much as breaking it down into sensors and actuators. It's just a more nuanced way of thinking about it, because these devices can give information out, which then can be processed, and then some of them also can do things. And so we're just going to learn to kind of talk about it in a more subtle way.
Yeah, I would pick up. I'd say this is a teachable moment technically. We're reprising battles from the 60s that led to the internet, and this is a good chance to relearn the lessons. The same roles are being played by about central versus distributed, and really the same solutions are applicable, but now at this level of individual devices.
Are the players getting are the players getting together to play nice on this?
There are people that are trying, and I think that we need to make sure that we really reinforce those. So there are open standards that are being formed to do this.
And I think the most interesting efforts are where the whole notion of sort of identity and naming, how you describe a light bulb, how you abstract the function. We know how to do the plumbing. How you describe things is one of the most interesting areas emerging for the common standards.
Because I was reading an article in the paper the other day about all these new LEDs that everybody's getting, light bulbs. They have more than just the light bulbs in them, but they've got all kinds of sensors now going along with them. As long as you're putting something in the ceiling, put this kind of sensor, that kind of sensor.
Well, some of them even have laser projectors in them, so you can actually put a display on your table by putting a light bulb in the ceiling.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And that would come from your tablet or something, or you would choose whatever you'd like to display on.
Well, again, if we have lots and lots of data, various things can be grabbing that and then, you know, bringing that in.
So some people are thinking about multitasking these objects.
Yeah, so that's the key part to the internet. If you go back to your light bulb, you may want to control it to vary what a light and a switch does. You may want to do it for a whole house for energy. You may want to do it for a whole city for grid power management and load peaking. The point is, one light bulb can talk on many different scales rather than it being fixed as it is done today.
Mm. Or you might want to use it for security, have a camera in it also.
Right.
Yeah. So what's the next step in getting all of this to work right?
If I were to project it forward, we have a couple years of reprising history. There'll be a battle between central and distributed, and kind of inevitably these open distributed solutions will scale better, they'll be more reliable, and they'll be more inventive, and that'll play out. Ultimately, I think the most interesting implication at the end, after we get through things like healthcare and energy, is the literal Internet of Things, when you start connecting the means to turn data into things and things into data. So literally, things can start traveling through the Internet is when we finally finish connecting the Internet to the physical world.
So you literally things traveling through the Internet.
All of the research on digital fabrication is leading to ways to turn data into things and things into data.
So there's a 3D printer on the end someplace.
A 3D printer is a very early crude version. The research behind it is in a much more literal way, how to actually turn data into the codes of construction of materials. Mm-hmm. And so the final frontier of the Internet of Things is where it becomes a permeable boundary, where objects can be scanned in, sent through the Internet, and made physical.
On the other end somewhere. And same with medicine, same with making DNA or something, biological products, and things like
that? So it's emerging of the digital fabrication story with the Internet of Things story is the ultimate frontier.
Well, we're going to revisit this because there's so much interesting stuff going on here, and we're going to pick this up. I think next time we'll talk about security and security concerns. Neil Gershenfeld is co-author of the article As Objects Go Online, out now in Foreign Affairs. He's also director of MIT's Center for Bits and Atoms in Cambridge. Scott Jensen is an interaction designer who works in product strategy at Google in California. Thank you both for joining us today. Good
luck.
Happy
to be here.
Always a pleasure.
Have a good weekend.